Welcome to another episode of Right Care at Baptist. I'm Jake Lancaster, an internal medicine physician and the chief medical officer for the Baptist Medical Group.
And I'm Amanda Comer. I'm the chief advanced practice officer.
And today we're excited to have back Krista Bockert to talk about tuberculosis. Krista is our system director for infectious disease pharmacy, and she's been on our show number of times, but today is a special episode. This is the first time we're doing this and actually recording video. So for those of you that are just listening on your audio player, know today that you can find us on YouTube now. So we're excited to have you back, Krista. Krista, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I enjoy being here and being able to share this information with everybody.
Yeah. So I think the majority of our listeners know what tuberculosis is. We've all had the TB skin test done over the years, but why are we talking about it today? Why is it important right now?
Because even though the incidence of TB is low in the United States, we're seeing an increase in several states within our tri-state area. And it's been about a 50% increase from 2023 to 2024. So our local health departments are kind of, you know, putting the flag up that, hey, we've got to watch this. This is a trend. And so also, what I didn't realize until kind of reading into this a little bit more is that there's 13 million people that are out there walking around that have latent tuberculosis that could turn into active TB at any time. Some people just depends on their immune systems and how their body reacts, but there are a lot of people in the United States as well as globally that actually have the tuberculosis in them, hibernating, and may or may not come out into an active infection at some point in time.
Wow. You know, in preparation for this podcast, we talked about how TB has been around forever. You know, we see it in movies and people relate it to a disease of olden day. But why is that a misconception?
Because like I said, it's still here. But I think because the misconception is that they have traced TB back to about 4,000 years to the Egyptian mummies. And so it's been around that long. And then in the 1600s to 1800s, it was kind of known as consumption, and 25% of the deaths were due to the tuberculosis at that time. And so it wasn't until we had Robert Koch, who determined the TB organism, discovered it, actually was the word I'm looking for, discovered it. And then from there, in the 1950s, we determined and discovered that there were treatment for it. And so that's when we started to see a decrease in tuberculosis, because it is a preventable and treatable disease whenever you identify it. But the problem is the identification of it.
Yeah. And so, you know, speaking of the identification, you were talking about tuberculosis or mycobacterium tuberculosis. You know, there's other mycobacterium, I guess, that we'll also see, you know, throughout our healthcare system. Can you tell us a little bit of the difference between the two and why we're concerned with one versus the other today?
With the tuberculosis, it tends to be a lot more invasive and can cause death in a lot of folks. Usually we see the tuberculosis in males, people who are immunocompromised, whereas in the non-mycobacterium tuberculosis patients, we usually see that in female patients. It used to have a syndrome called Lady Windermere syndrome is how it...
Yeah, I was looking that up. That was something, you know, I'd heard from medical school, and Wikipedia will reprimand you and say that is an outdated eponym and we should not be using that anymore. But that's how I always remembered it.
Yes. And, you know, it's fascinating, the Oscar Wilde story, mm-hmm. and how that the whole Lady Windermere kind of followed that whole transgression and disease process of tuberculosis in that case.
Interesting. So let's talk about transmission. Mm-hmm. How is TB transmitted?
It's transmitted through airborne, respiratory, usually close contacts with people who are coughing, talking, singing. It doesn't really last very long on surfaces. You can't get it from touching doorknobs or eating after somebody, but it has to be that direct isolate coming from a patient and going into your respiratory tract.
Yeah. So prior to COVID, you know, the only time I ever wore an N95 mask was when I had a patient with tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. And so is that still what we need to do when we go in and see a patient that has tuberculosis?
Yes. N95 is still proper PPE along with your gowning and gloving and making sure we're washing hands. all of those, you know, regular PPE things. We also need to make sure that they're in negative pressure rooms whenever they're in our hospitals, because the fact that we want those TB bacteria to go out through the ventilation system and not go out into the hallways. And so, you know, PPE is the other big part of this, and making sure that our employees and family members are following proper PPE precautions. If you have a patient who's going to be transported through the hallway, then they can wear a surgical mask to permit the airborne bacteria to be transmitted to you. But then for you to protect yourself, you need to wear the N95 mask.
That sounds right. Okay. What are the hallmark symptoms that we as clinicians or the community should know about?
Persistent cough, usually lasting longer than 3 weeks. If you have any chest pain, night sweats, fever, coughing up blood or sputum, those are kind of the big hallmark symptoms. Weight loss, if I didn't say that, that's a big one too. And so those are the big hallmark signs, you know, night sweats, fever, persistent cough with some weight loss should be your classic signs of maybe putting the TB on the differential.
Yeah, red flag for it.
Yeah, so, you know, cough. You know, we're in December right now. Mm-hmm. Almost everybody I see has a cough.
Right.
What populations are more at risk for tuberculosis?
Those that are immunocompromised, specifically HIV patients, they have a 10 to 100 times relative risk of developing TB, and it's probably the number one cause of infectious disease-related death within HIV patients. And with Memphis being the number two city in the country for newly diagnosed HIV patients, that's really something that is big for us to be concerned about. Also, a lot of the patients that do develop TB are also non-US born mm-hmm. folks. And so if you have someone who's coming into the clinic that either was born outside the United States or has traveled outside the United States to an area where TB is a little bit more endemic, then you need to kind of put that on your differential as well. So really, like with any infectious disease, getting a good history and physical, getting a good physical exam can really tell you a lot about what's going on with your patient without going into a lot of the other things that we use to help us diagnose infections.
Well, that was my next question. What primary care practices could we integrate to better screen?
Really, for screening, if you have someone who's at high risk, doing a baseline QuantiFERON test is kind of the gold standard at this point. You can still use TB skin testing. A couple of things that are a little bit problematic with the TB skin testing, which makes it not maybe the best choice for some of the primary care practices, is that it requires the skin test to be placed and then the patient to come back 48 or 72 hours later to be read. So that's two visits. Also, if they don't come back, then you've got to do it again. And sometimes whenever you're placing the TB skin test over and over again, it itself can cause kind of a false positive test because it's reacting to the previous TB skin test. So the QuantiFERON test is a blood test that can be done. It won't tell you if you have latent or active TB, but it'll tell you that you have that tuberculosis bacterium within your system. And then it doesn't interfere with those patients who have gotten the TB vaccine before. TB vaccine is not something that's typically done here in the United States. It's usually done in foreign countries. And it's to prevent the younger children from developing more severe forms of TB as they go through life in the areas where they have more TB. So if you have somebody that has been vaccinated before, a TB skin test will cause that, will always be positive in somebody who's had that vaccine, whereas the QuantiFERON TB test will not.
All right, let's take a step back a second. We've said the words latent and active quite a few times, and I think a lot of people know what we mean, but just to be sure, what are we talking about with latent and active, and how do we diagnose both of those different categories?
So latent TB is when you have inactive TB. Patients don't feel sick. They don't have any symptoms. They can't spread the TB bacteria to others. And whenever they do have inactive TB, they may not think they need treatment because they don't feel sick. So that's one of the other challenges with making sure that people are getting treatment, because 80% of the TB cases in the U.S. are from patients who convert from latent TB to active TB.
Okay.
And so that's really kind of the big thing with latent, is that there's not a whole lot that you can of outward signs and symptoms. You have to look for it. You have to test for it. And that's where that quantiferin TB test that I talked about comes into play, as well as the TB skin testing. So you have either one of those methods to test for.
So, I guess along those lines, as a healthcare provider, we've all been tested for latent TB. But when, as a practitioner, should we test a patient for latent TB?
If they have any signs and symptoms or have any risk factors for it,
okay.
If they've been exposed to someone who has active TB, and that's where, as healthcare workers, if you have an exposure to your employee, then we'll do a screening on them. Because right now, for a hospital, we do quantiferin TBs at baseline for our employees,
mm-hmm.
and then we do some annual questions to ask about signs and symptoms every year annually. But if there is an exposure, then we will test them with a quantiferin TB at the time of exposure and then have them come back 8 to 10 weeks later to have another test, because of the fact that it takes 6 to 8 weeks for this TB bacteria to grow and be able to identify it. So it's not something that's going to have immediate signs and symptoms of infection.
Gotcha. So that was latent TB. Now, what about how to diagnose active TB? You gave us the picture of what that looks like earlier, but how do we diagnose it?
Diagnosing that is where you get the AFB smear, which is the acid-fast bacilli smear. If it's positive, it will tell you whether or not you have mycobacterium or not. And that's where it goes back to where we have the non-mycobacterium and the mycobacterium tuberculosis. So it won't tell you the difference between the two. It'll just tell you that you have a mycobacterium within your body with the AFB smear. Then that AFB smear will result within 24 hours as negative or positive. And you need to have 3 AFB smears to increase your ability to determine whether or not you have TB from a smear, because it depends on the volume of bacteria that are in the smear, whether or not the lab can pick up on it, because it is something that the lab will do. The lab will take it and put it on media to allow it to grow over the 6 to 8 week period. And that's what we call the AFB culture, and the culture is what our gold standard is. So even though all these other tests that we're doing to try to help us guide whether or not we have TB or not, sometimes they'll be normal and the patient will still have active TB. So that's where the challenge is, yeah. Is that everybody responds differently. Sometimes the quantiferin TB test will be positive, sometimes it'll be negative in patients with active TB. The other test that they do is the mycobacterium tuberculosis PCR test.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty sensitive and specific as far as tests go, but it does not replace the AFB culture. But it's a test that we can do. It's a nucleic acid amplification test that the lab can do. If you have the ability to do it in-house, the testing methods, you can get results back within 2 to 4 hours. If you have to send it out, it may be 5 to 7 days turnaround. So it depends on what your lab is doing, what your turnaround time is for it. But for someone in a hospital that is able to do the testing in-house, that's a lot of decreased PPE. That's a lot of, kind of a little bit more confidence in being able to decrease the exposure to employees and things by knowing within 2 to 4 hours, with about 95% sensitivity specificity, that you have TB or not.
Yeah.
But again, you may have a patient that it may be negative. So you have to wait for that culture to grow. But that mycobacterium tuberculosis PCR is kind of the better, more quick test that we can do to kind of spot check. And that's one of the things that are required by the health department. The other thing that's sometimes done is do an HIV test, because the fact that HIV patients are 10 to 100 times relative risk of developing TB and then eventually potentially dying from it, that, we want to do the HIV screen on the beginning so that we can be able to treat them appropriate with ART as well. Because HIV patients, they're one of the biggest groups of patients that don't react the way we expect them to for TB. A lot of times they're tests because they don't have the immune system.
Yeah.
Their chest x-ray may be normal. Their quantiferin TB may be negative or indeterminate. And so with that That's one of the big things that we need to test for as well, is if they don't have a previous diagnosis of HIV, we need to be making sure that we're screening for that as well.
Talk to me a little bit. You mentioned chest x-ray. Is there a red flag that I need to look for on a chest x-ray that might indicate potential tuberculosis?
Usually cavitary lesions is the big thing. The biggest thing, some hilar lymphadenopathy. It can also present with some opacification, but that's kind of a little bit more nonspecific. One of the other big ways is pleural effusions. A lot of times we don't think about TB as causing pleural effusions, but that's one of the things that ways in which TB can present is with a pleural effusion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, remembering a lot. We've diagnosed an active TB case, or we've diagnosed somebody with latent TB. What do we do? How do we treat it?
Well, with latent TB, there we have a couple of regimens, but all are longer term therapy. We can do some 4 months of rifampin. We can do three months of daily isoniazid plus rifampin. It all depends on patients' comorbidities, their risk factors, their drug interactions. So not everybody's treatment is always going to be the same. So that makes it a little bit more challenging. And that's why working with the health department with these patients is so important. Because they do have experts in this, and a lot of times they're driving what these patients should be using to treat.
And so just with that latent TB, so you're saying 4 months of treatment for somebody that doesn't even feel bad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then there also is a regimen that's a longer regimen, which is kind of what I know from my training, is 6 to 9 months of isoniazid monotherapy, but it has some serious toxicity that goes along with it. And then because of the length of time, there's lower completion rates as well. And then if somebody has an adverse effect, they're not going to complete that treatment either. Right. So that 6 to 9 month regimen it's still available, but we try not to use that as much for treatment of latent TB. But if we know that we have latent TB and we can treat it, then we can prevent the spread to others. And so that's the biggest important take home message, is that we need to be looking for these people who are high risk. Trying to be a little bit more proactive with diagnosing them and looking for it. And then for active TB, there's two different regimens. The new guidelines just came out in January of 2025. That was a collaboration with ATS, CDC, the European Respiratory Society, and IDSA. And so now they're recommending either a 4 month regimen composed of 2 months of isoniazid, rifampentine, pyrazinamide, and moxifloxacin, followed by 2 months of treatment with isoniazid, rifampentine, and moxifloxacin. Or there's a 6 month regimen that can be done too, where it's 2 months of isoniazid, rifampin, pyrazinamide, and the thiobutal, which is kind of like the old fashioned regimen that we know, followed by 4 months of INH and rifampin. That one tends to be not adhered to as much, but we also have directly observed therapy with this. So that's one other difference between latent TB and active TB, is that we want to make sure that patients are getting their treatment. And so they will need to go usually to the health department and be observed actually taking their medicine to treat the TB on a daily basis.
Yeah. And do they isolate at the house, or what are they doing during these 4 months or 6 months?
They will isolate for a period of time. But it's not for the entire 4 to 6 months. It's for a short period of time at the beginning until they feel confident that they've cleared some of that bacteria out.
So I need to replace my algorithm. It's not ripe therapy anymore. It's a combination of some of those, but not all of them.
It could be really right now. The two standard therapies are ripe or PRIM. PRIM is the other acronym. That's where the moxifloxacin will come in, is the M. So we can do RIPE, which is the 6 to 9 month, 6 month regimen.
Thiobutal.
Yes. Or they can do the newer regimen that's 4 months, which is the PRIM. And so I think it depends on the local health department. Some things that I've read, there's been some adverse effects that they feel like are a little bit more with the PRIM therapy. So some health departments have kind of held off until a little bit more data has come out.
Okay.
But the data that's out there shows that they have similar response rates with the 4 month regimen versus the 6 month regimen.
What about drug resistance?
Well, drug resistance, that's luckily something that's low here in the United States. But treatment is complicated. You know, we have the comorbid conditions, we have the drug interactions, you know, especially with the HIV patients. But multi-drug resistant TB is when we have resistance to two of our mainstays of therapy, which is isoniazid or rifampin. So that's what we've seen in the United States. Luckily, we have not seen the extensively drug resistant TB or the pre-extensively drug resistant TB in the United States. It's only been the multi-drug. But with the extensively drug resistant TB, that's when we're resistant to the fluoroquinolones plus one of our second line IV therapies that we don't typically use or see. So, okay. But treatment is a lot longer. It can range from 9 to 24 months in somebody who has a multi-drug. And treatment success is usually pretty low with that if you have multi-drug resistant TB. And there's new therapies that have come out. I'm not quite as familiar with those, but they are referenced in the IDSA guidelines that have come out in 2025. And there's a lot of discussion with those to come for those patients. But for the testing that we do here at Baptist, we're able to tell, at least from the when we do the Mycobacterium TB PCR testing, it will tell us if we have rifampin resistance within that. We have to wait for the culture to come back, and that's why we still have to send the culture, because they'll test that for drug resistance. So whenever you get that 6 to 8 week positive culture that you have TB, it will also have drug sensitivities eventually available to you as well. So you'll be able to tell from your culture and sensitivity like you would any other bacteria. It just takes a lot longer to get back with TB.
Well, it sounds like we need to do a better job of detecting our latent TB cases now so they don't become the drug-resistant cases later.
Yeah, and the other thing I think is important, too, is having it on your differential when you have that patient come in. I think a lot of times we think that TB is an old disease that not everybody's going to get, and we associate it with, you know, developing countries. And, you know, it's something that is here, too, in the United States, especially with everybody who is, you know, visiting and traveling, and, you know, we have all of this resistance being transmitted with gram-negative resistance as well from travel. And so I think having TB at least on your differential, when you have those keywords on your x-ray or your CT saying cavitary lesion, lymphadenopathy, those are kind of your keywords that you need to kind of start thinking maybe and looking at the risk factors the patients have to see if you really need to move that higher up on your differential list.
Yeah.
That's good. What about technology, AI, any use of technology that you see?
It's coming.
Okay.
There was a study that came out in New England Journal in September of 2024, where it showed that you can use AI with diagnosing TB, usually done in developing countries where they don't have radiology and radiologist support. So there, it may be miles and miles away. There's, you know, not every hospital has a radiologist or a region that has a radiologist. So they have showed that in areas where TB is high, the prevalence is high, and HIV is high, that AI actually performs a little better than radiology.
Mm-hmm.
But in areas where there's not as high a prevalence, neither AI nor the radiologists do as well as what the World Health Organization wants them to do in diagnosing. So that even shows you, even the experts have challenges in trying to pick up these things that, you know, things, it's been around for a long time, but we're still having challenges to be able to identify it on radiography.
Well, it's not a podcast unless we talk about AI, but I really appreciate it. I really appreciate your time today. I always learn a lot. Is there anything else you want to leave with the audience?
I think just making sure to do that good history and physical and medical exam, looking for those key words of, you know, cavitary and lymphadenopathy, and maybe even your pleural effusion patients, you know, considering TB and your differential, because, you know, it is here. And apparently it's increasing within our region. So we need to keep an eye out for it and make sure we get the health department involved early and often when we have suspected cases.
Well said. And thank you. I always learn a lot again from you. And I'm sure we're going to have you back on soon to talk about another infectious diseases. But Thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Right Here at Baptist, or thank you for watching for the first time. Remember, if you follow the link in the show notes, you can redeem this episode for CME credit.